Hello and welcome to the Canadian Baseball Network podcast. I'm Peter Bean and I'll be your host. In today's episode, I'm joined by Bill Humber. Bill is a baseball historian and teaches the Spring Training for Fans course every spring at Seneca College. Bill is also the author of many books about Canadian baseball and other topics. Most recently, we published one of Bill's research projects on the origins of Canadian baseball. Any true Canadian baseball fan must read this. I've reposted the links on this piece on the page for this podcast, and you can also find it in the Sandlot section of our site. Bill joins us on this episode to discuss the 2013 class at the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. Bill is speaking this weekend in St. Mary's for Nat Bailey, one of this year's inductees. With his knowledge and years of study on baseball in Canada, Bill is the perfect guide to walk us through this year's inductee class. So without further delay, let's listen to the interview with baseball historian Bill Humber.
So before we get into the inductees, I want to start and ask you a little bit about yourself. And most importantly, I wanted to ask you, what's your first memory of baseball from your childhood?
Good question. My father, who came out from England after the war, was naturally a soccer and cricket fan, but pretty quickly realized that neither of those games was very big in Toronto when he arrived in the late 40s, and so became a baseball fan. And so I was born in 1949, my brother in 51, and he would take us down to Old Maple Leaf Stadium on Front Street, and we had some delightful afternoons watching baseball down there. I can remember teams, for instance, such as the Havana Sugar Kings and the Montreal Royals and others coming through town. It really was an international league.
Were the Toronto Maple Leafs the first team that you got to see in a real baseball game?
They were. I didn't see a Major League Baseball game until 1969 in Detroit at Old Tiger Stadium. So my baseball memories were formed by not only minor league ball, but one of the finest minor league baseball stadiums there was, the Maple Leaf Stadium, as I say, at the foot of Bathurst Street.
Now, of all the ballparks you've been to in your life, majors and minor leagues, which one would be your favorite?
Well, it's actually a fairly recent ballpark. It's Pittsburgh's PNC Stadium. It's located almost at the confluence of the Three Rivers, for which Pittsburgh is famous, and it has a wonderful view of kind of downtown Pittsburgh, and it's a very walkable city. It's a city that transitioned out of its steel industry past and has become kind of not only a tourist destination, but also kind of a banking center, and has some fantastic museums, such as the Andy Warhol Museum. But the ballpark is a real treasure because, as I say, it's an enjoyable place to watch a game. There's an incredible diversity of foodstuffs available inside. I know the day we went to see a game against the St. Louis Cardinals, we didn't even know this. They told us it was half price day, so and they gave us a hat when we went in. I thought, hey, this is pretty darn good. So I'm a bit of a fan of Pittsburgh's new stadium.
What's your favorite team?
Well, I'm a Blue Jays fan, and why shouldn't I be? I grew up in Toronto. I cheered for the Montreal Expos when they originally came into the National League in 1969, and I guess in many ways I still continue to do so right through to their end days in, about 2004. But the Blue Jays, obviously, being based in Toronto and so many factors around that and going to so many games over the years, obviously for me, when the Blue Jays won the World Series, their back-to-backs in 92-93, I remember saying at the time, I can finally die in peace. I've seen my team win a championship.
Oh, that's great. I want to ask you about your class. You've been running this spring training course for fans at Seneca for, I think, 35 years, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the course and what you cover?
Yeah, I started Seneca College in 1977 in continuing education, and I noticed we ran courses on just about every possible topic one could think of. Remember, we had a course, for instance, on The Prisoner, the old TV series with Patrick McGoohan, and it would always sell out. And I thought, well, you know, if a television show can sell out, I wonder if baseball would. You know, I love the game. I'd love to teach it, and I've got an opportunity here, given that I'm at Seneca, to put a course together on it. So I wrestled together a course called Baseball Spring Training for Fans, and the basic premise was the players go to Florida, at that time they primarily did, to get ready for the season. What do the fans do? And I came up with the idea, well, let's run baseball spring training for fans in a classroom in Toronto from late January through early March. And as I say, the first time I ran it in 1979, we had about 35 people, and it's never fallen, you know, far from that number ever since. And in fact, our first guest, the first person we ever had in as a speaker was the late Tom Cheek. So I have a kind of a warm spot, I guess, in my heart for the fact that Tom Cheek is going into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame this year.
Me too, actually. I spoke with Shirley yesterday about Tom, and I learned a lot about who he was as a person. And I have to admit, I think I would have been really good friends with him if I had had the opportunity to meet him. I wanted to ask you about the who speaks at the class in the last year. For example, the course that you did this spring training, who are some of the guests?
Yeah, let's start right at the top. Paul Beeston. Paul has come out probably 6 or 7 times over the years. Always a delight. Always has new stories to tell. Always, you know, he has that ability to kind of bend forward and say, I probably shouldn't be telling you this story, and keep it to yourself. And you can hear a pin drop in the room. And the story he tells is never that consequential, never that, you know, if the story ever got out, nobody would say, well, what was the big deal? But he's got a way of bringing people into his confidence, which is quite endearing. But who else did I have this year? Mike Wilner, of course, who is on the Blue Jay broadcasts. I had two writers in, John Lott of the National Post, and John had actually taken the course about 20 years ago, so it was fun to have him back as I like to think as a successful graduate of the program. And Bob Elliott, of course, of the Toronto Sun. Bob, you know, is really Mr. Baseball writer, and of course was acknowledged as such by Cooperstown last year in the writer's section of the Baseball Hall of Fame. So those kind of folks really add a dimension of reality, I guess, to the class and make people feel that they're kind of getting an inside story that they might not have gotten from anywhere else.
Now, over the past 35 years, what are some of your favorite guests or favorite memories from guests that you've had?
Well, we've been very fortunate. I had some folks in who had been associated with the Negro Leagues back in the days. I had folks associated with the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League in. I had the great W.P. Kinsella before he became notable for his work on Shoeless Joe, which, of course, led to the movie Field of Dreams. Paul Querington, the writer who'd written a book on baseball and midgets. It was kind of an odd kind of class, but we had a good bit of fun with that. And we've had significant, you know, personalities from the Blue Jays. Pat Gillick, when he was here, was a regular attendee. Paul Quantrill came in once. Jesse Barfield came in once. So we've had a real range of personalities associated with the game.
How many years does your longest-standing classmate have returning to the program?
Well, I have a fellow named Bill Maxwell. He wouldn't mind me giving out his name. He's been coming every year. He was a lawyer in Toronto. He's now retired, but I've got people that happily, you know, say this is their 25th year or their 28th year or their 32nd year. So I like, you know, we kind of jokingly say nobody ever actually graduates from this course. They just kind of, it's continuous learning, and we say that with good humor.
So you only do this in spring training, correct? People's next opportunity to join this program would be next spring?
That's correct. The next offering would be about 2 weeks towards the end, two Saturdays towards the end of January, and going to the first Saturday in March, just 6 Saturdays. And, of course, it's Bill Humber at Seneca College, so I'm easy to track down. People sometimes call Humber College, and they have no luck getting me there, but if they call Seneca and ask for myself, I can certainly put them on a list and send out the information when the next offering of year 36 will be held.
You can put me on that list.
Good.
I want to ask you about a lot of Sabre guys, you know, really attached to new age stats and evolving
right.
How we look at the game. I want to know what attracts you to the history of the game.
Yeah, I've often said that Sabre, the Society for American Baseball Research, really has two elements to it and two kind of two sides to it. One is that statistical side that one might call it the Moneyball side, the Bill Jamesian side, the ability to look at numbers in new ways, or even look at factors associated with baseball that people perhaps hadn't spent as much time on as they might have in the past. I find it interesting, but I'm not a stat historian, if that's the right term for them. I'm more a narrative historian. I'm more interested in the stories associated with baseball, the unknown stories. I remember, oh gee whiz, it's now getting on 35, 36 years when I remember reading that there'd been a game played in Beachville, Ontario, and it just so intrigued me that this game had happened in 1838, 1 year before the mythological origin of baseball in Cooperstown, that fact alone, that 1838 game in Ontario, spurred me to really research, and I continue to do so, to dig as deep as I can into that whole period of 19th century baseball in Canada, but particularly Ontario, where the game really was rooted, at a very early stage, much earlier than most people realize. In some ways, it was more deeply rooted here, 40 years before hockey really caught on in any kind of substantial form. So it really has a deep and enduring history in the country.
You've done a lot of research. Does it ever get tiresome? So much data that you have to go through.
Yeah, I once kind of jokingly said, that I've done so much research, but so much of it was a while ago now, and I've been living off the avails of procrastination for a while, that I really got intrigued by a guy named William Shuttleworth, who was accredited or said to be the first, to form the first baseball team ever in Canada. That was the Young Canadian of Hamilton in 1854. And so I started Googling, of course, as we all do when we're trying to look for more information. And all my searches just simply led back to me. And that was frustrating because I hardly knew anything. And I said, if that's the depth of our knowledge about William Shuttleworth, it's pretty poor. So I committed myself about 6 months ago to finding out who this guy William Shuttleworth was, and I've now satisfied myself that while one never completes one's research on any topic, I've now put together an effective enough story about William Shuttleworth that I'm going to put him forward for nomination to Canada's Baseball Hall of Fame for next year, because he truly is, in from my research now, I can firmly say he is the father of the game in Canada. He started the first team. He was one of the first really good players. He was a vice president of the first ever Canadian Baseball Association in 1864. He was a noted umpire. He umpired championship matches in the late 1860s. So he kind of did it all as that kind of one of those first kind of innovators in the game of baseball in Canada.
Now, you're a published author as well. You've written some books on baseball, Canadian baseball, and some other topics. One that I wanted to mention, that I wanted to ask you about, you wrote a book with your son recently.
Correct.
About keeping... Tell us about that book. I don't want to tell... Let you tell people about it.
Yeah, it was called Let It Snow, Keeping Canada's Winter Sports Alive. And our three kids and my middle child, Daryl, and I wrote the book on the premise that the upcoming, this was in 2009 when the book came out, on the premise that the upcoming Winter Olympics to be held in Vancouver just might be the last Winter Olympics ever held in Canada, because if the effective impact of climate change is such that we don't have winter, or the conditions are too unpredictable to make it feasible to have winter games, we may not have the Winter Olympics ever again in Canada. Or what we might find is that, in fact, the Winter Olympics will gradually go totally indoors. And we might laugh at that, but we should remember that at least as recently as the 1960 Winter Olympics in Squaw Valley in California, some of the ice hockey was actually held on outdoor rinks. And as recently as 1948, when Barbara Ann Scott won the gold medal in women's figure skating, she had to do it on an outdoor skating rink in Saint-Moritz, Switzerland. So, going indoors is not as absurd, perhaps, as it might have sounded when I, originally thought of the idea.
Now, Bob told me you're organizing a trip to Cooperstown. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've run about 25 trips to Cooperstown over the years, starting in 1979. We thought it was just a kind of a logical extension of the course would be, well, we got together in the winter, what are we going to do in the summer? Well, let's go to Cooperstown. And at the time, of course, the Blue Jays farm team was in Syracuse, so we'd always stop off there and see the Jays farm team. This year, we had planned to go to Cooperstown and stop in Buffalo and see the Jays farm team, which is now in Buffalo. Unfortunately, it isn't going to happen. We just didn't get enough people registered signed up for it. So whether the fact that we're not going to Syracuse was a deal breaker or not, I don't know. But we won't be going this year.
Okay, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about each of this year's inductees into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. Let's start with Rob Ducey of Cambridge, Ontario. He was actually on our show yesterday.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about milestones and highlights of Ducey's career that you can remember, the things that stand out to you.
Well, I remember being at the game where he hit his first ever home run for the Blue Jays, and I, if you asked me the year, I wouldn't be able to tell you now, although I could certainly look it up. I remember I've been an advocate of Rob Ducey going in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame for a couple of years. One of the big challenges we find with something like the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame is that oftentimes you find you're comparing apples and oranges. In other words, Rob Ducey's career, if you put them on the same level, wouldn't compare with George Bell's career. But George Bell, came here. He worked for the Blue Jays. He won a Most Valuable Player award, but he's not a Canadian. Rob Ducey is a Canadian and played, a significant number of years in the major leagues here and in Japan. I think about 15 seasons. So he clearly proved himself as a talented Canadian ball player, and did so over such a lengthy span of time that, from my perspective, I'm just really glad that we're putting him into the Canada's Baseball Hall of Fame this year.
Can you tell me something that not very many people would know about Rob Ducey? It'd be an interesting little-known fact.
Well, I'm told he actually started. He didn't actually start playing baseball. He started playing softball, and to make that transition, it's one thing to go from baseball to softball. Usually, as one ages, that's the usual route that one takes. To go the other way is a lot more unusual for a variety of reasons. Softball, of course, has different size ball, a different set of rules in terms of the spaces between the bases, as it were. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of a pitcher batter game. It isn't as much of the kind of fully dimensional character of baseball. So I think it's quite an extraordinary thing that a young man can start out in that route, and then his talent clearly was so well developed that somebody at some point just said, you got to try baseball. And he did. And of course the rest, as they say, is history.
He told me yesterday when I spoke to him, and this part just shocked me, he said that there was a time when he was younger where he almost quit baseball in favor of softball and fast pitch. He said baseball was too slow and boring.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, let's talk about Nat Bailey.
Right.
You're speaking on Nat Bailey's behalf this week at the induction ceremony, correct?
That's correct. And I'm largely relying on the commentary of Nat Bailey's grandson, Mark Andrews Bailey, who unfortunately was unable to attend, but provided a lot of the commentary. And I thought, you know what? What Mark has said is so kind of from the heart that I'm going to keep my comments on Nat Bailey to a minimum. I'm going to read what Mark said, because I think, as a grandson and as somebody who, clearly had a soft spot in his heart for his grandfather, who would actually come and watch him play as a child. Nat Bailey, of course, is no longer with us, but would watch Mark as a child. For him, obviously, this was a pretty heart-fulfilling moment for him to see his grandfather go into Canada's Baseball Hall of Fame.
Now, Scott Crawford told me a little bit about Nat Bailey's contributions to baseball in British Columbia, and I'll admit my knowledge of Nat Bailey's contributions is limited.
Yep.
I'm hoping you could give myself and our listeners who may not know a brief history lesson on
sure.
who Nat Bailey is and his place in Canadian baseball history.
Yeah, he arrived in Vancouver in the early 20th century. And as a child and grew up in Vancouver and not only became a tremendous baseball follower and supporter, I mean, he literally started at the bottom end of selling peanuts in the ballpark type of thing. Vancouver has a long and glorious history of both amateur baseball and minor league baseball. Obviously, they'd never had a major league team. And that's where Bailey got started. But he was an extraordinary entrepreneur as well. And he got in early in the kind of the drive-in fast food restaurant business. And so to this day, the restaurant chain that he established, the White Spot Restaurants, are known at least throughout British Columbia and Alberta. They one of those kind of local chains that if you're outside of the area, you've never heard of them. But if you ever go there as a visitor or live there, of course, everybody knows White Spot. So he obviously became a relatively affluent man as a result of that. And in later years, as he became friendly with Bob Brown, who was involved with minor league professional baseball and amateur baseball in Vancouver, the two of them really became kind of a partnership in terms of scouting and in terms of developing teams and recruiting players. And Vancouver, of course, was in the Western International League after the Second World War. But that was a period of decline in minor league baseball. And it was Nat Bailey who basically was the angel, financial angel of teams in that period when they couldn't meet their payroll or the gate receipts were not what was anticipated. Nat Bailey was the guy who stepped in and from his own personal wealth helped sustain the game in the city. To the point that today the ballpark in Vancouver is actually is Nat Bailey Stadium. He's recognized in the name of it. And of course, the Toronto Blue Jays have a single A minor league affiliate in Vancouver that plays out of that stadium. So that connection remains resilient to this day.
I'm wondering if you could share some of the comments that you were going to make in the speech that you're now not going to make since you're using the other one.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Well, what I want to do is I think sometimes we forget these the people behind the scenes. They aren't the management of the team. They're not the guys that select the players. The business types that sometimes they get, I don't know, negative image, or sometimes they don't receive the due there that's owing to them. But let's face it, if people like Charles Bronfman in Montreal and Howard Webster and Don McDougall in Toronto, these are the people that made it possible for Major League Baseball to come to those cities. And I would argue that more in a more contemporary vein, the late Ted Rogers and now Nadir Mohammed, the head of Rogers, these are their support and the finances they made available and the resources they made available have, in my mind, allowed baseball to survive and prosper in Toronto. Had Rogers not come in and bought the team, who knows where the Blue Jays, they'd probably still be in Toronto, but it's a big if. And in Montreal, we saw that just because you have a major league franchise doesn't mean it's going to be there forever. So I think we have to be very, we should be cognizant of the role that financial angels or business types or entrepreneurs who sometimes don't get their due should get their due in terms of their support for the game of baseball.
Slightly off topic, but related to the answer that you just gave. Montreal and Vancouver. Can Montreal ever support another major league team, and do you think Vancouver will ever be able to support one?
Well, 25 years ago, people talked about Vancouver as if it was inevitable that there would be a major league team, but they were saying the same thing about 40 years ago about Buffalo, and of course, Buffalo's population has been declining ever since, and so it's never going to happen in my mind. Vancouver is a bit more difficult to say because it's still a growing city, a very prosperous city. It's just that Major League Baseball shows no inclination for expansion at the present time, although one only has to watch games from Tampa to see that here's a franchise where, despite the fact that they're a competitive baseball team, nobody seems to go to their games, so it's a little baffling, that phenomenon. But then again, they have a long-term lease in Tampa, so the likelihood is they're not going anywhere anytime soon. So I would say the prospects for both Montreal and Vancouver are very low at this point. And, you know, I don't want to be too discouraging, but I think realistically we have to say that it would take something out of the extraordinary for them to get into Major League Baseball.
Okay, let's talk about Tim Raines.
Yeah.
With regards to, I want to start with his Cooperstown standing. Some of the numbers I was looking at, 2001 at 37.5% mm-hmm. of the vote, 48% in 2012, and 52% in 2013. Votes are on the rise. Do you think he's going to eventually get in?
Yes, I think the one thing about the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown is that when your numbers are in that direction, inevitably you will be in the Hall of Fame. You don't want the numbers going the other way, because that means you peaked early and people have started to think about you and said, you know, there's worthier candidates that have come along. Raines, of course, suffers from the fact that there was the drug incident in the early part of his career, and so to some extent he is being punished for that. But I think in the long term, the recognition of you know, his distinct skills are such that eventually he will be in the Hall of Fame.
For younger baseball fans who might not have gotten to see Tim play, what were those skills? What made Tim Raines a special
player? Well, he had tremendous speed. You know, he was kind of one of those, you know, you think five-tool players in terms of that ability to steal bases, run down balls, hit, you know, get on base. An incredibly talented player who, you know, would have had, I think if he'd played anywhere else but Montreal, he'd already be in the Baseball Hall of Fame right now. It's just unfortunate that a player in Montreal, you know, a lot of people didn't see him, a lot of writers didn't see him, and so writers are prepared to listen to good arguments and to look at the statistics, but if they haven't seen them or had personal contact with them, it's usually a longer process.
George Bell.
Yeah.
Okay. I read a piece by Bob about the Hall of Fame from back in February, and he mentioned in that piece that the addition of George Bell to the 2013 class may have had its genesis in your classroom at Seneca.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. We have a fellow who's probably taken my course for about 25 years, Ted Shillington, and I had Bob Elliott in as a guest, and we told the class we're going to have a telephone conversation today with our fellow selectors, and we're going to be, you know, discussing back and forth some of the candidates, putting forth our arguments for certain, you know, candidates. And Ted, you know, said, well, I don't understand. You know, everyone who's on that kind of wall of honor in Rogers Center is in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame with the exception of George Bell. Why? And, well, that's always, you know, a rhetorical question, I guess. Well, the easy answer is he didn't get enough votes. Now, it turns out that wasn't quite accurate because Tom Cheek at the time also hadn't been voted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. We knew at that time, Bob and I had a pretty good indication that Cheek was probably going to get in this year. But George Bell was a more problematic case. He was he didn't, you know, his vote number, as it were, wasn't going up. And so we raised that issue with the group and said, you know, this, by the way, this is his last year of eligibility. And, you know, we might want to give some pretty serious consideration to, you know, to his position relative to Canada's Baseball Hall of Fame. And both Bob and I spoke to that issue, and for whatever reason, it seemed to do the trick because, well, he's going in the Hall of Fame this year.
Do you know what kind of player George Bell was in the clubhouse?
I think he was a bit of an irascible sort. You know, he had a pretty strong point of view. He had a lot of pride in his background and who he was. And you know, I mean, the famous incident when Jimmy Williams wanted, you know, to move him into the DH position, and he wanted to continue fielding, and that really created tremendous rancor in the clubhouse, and it, probably some of that did not reflect well on Bell himself. Some of it may have been naivety on Jimmy Williams, you know, the manager's part at the time. So I think it was a combination of factors that eventually, you know, it had some degree of resolution, but Bell obviously did not finish his career in Toronto, and that may have played a role in that.
Bell came to the Jays as a Rule 5 pick, right?
Correct. That's right.
You think of any more that have had a more successful career after going through Rule 5?
I can't think of anyone. Of course, Kelly Gruber was in that category as well. I believe Manny Lee was as well. And, you know, Lee and Gruber, of course, were both on the 92 World Series winning team. Bell had left by that point. But certainly in terms of the ultimate accomplishment of a career, which is, as an individual, is winning the Most Valuable Player Award, which, of course, Bell won in 87. I mean, stands out as just an extraordinary accomplishment. And the story is that, you know, Epi Guerrero knew this guy was going to become available. And I'd forgotten the team he was with, but they tried to hide him. They tried to keep him away from prying eyes so that, you know, he wouldn't be claimed. But the Jays had got wind that he was going to be available, and so they picked him up, and it turned out to be an extraordinary move.
Let's talk about Tom Cheek.
Mm-hmm.
You said at the beginning of the interview that you had a warm spot in your heart for Tom Cheek. Did you know him personally?
I didn't know him personally. As I say, I did have him out. He was the first ever guest I had to my baseball spring training for fans class. It brought kind of from my end and from the people in the classes perspective a kind of an instant credibility to it. It was the only one and only time he came. We've had Jerry Howarth come out on many occasions after that, but I mean, Tom obviously was a commanding presence, maybe that's the best way to put it, and one I think captured that in listening to his broadcasts, the over 4,000 games in a row that he did as the broadcaster for the Jays. It's still a number that is it's hard to believe, actually, in retrospect, that, you know, somebody could, you know, hang in for that amount of time. Clearly he was very fortunate to be there for the winning of the two World Series victories. I think even, you know, if he were around today, he would obviously, those would have been career highlights, you know, for to start with an expansion team with few prospects, and to see them rise in a very short order. I mean, if one thinks about it, I mean, this is a team that could have won the World Series in 1985 and, you know, just basically within about their eighth season in the major leagues. So they had a very, you know, quick ascent and were a competitive team, obviously, from 1983 right through 1993, makes it all the more frustrating that they've essentially not been a competitive team now for almost 20 years. You know, Tom Cheek clearly was there for the glory years, and you know, and his presence was such that he was able to capture, you know, that the essence of those years.
From what I understand, he was a part-time broadcaster with the Expos before. Do you know how Tom got the job as the full-time broadcaster for the
Jays? Yeah, I mean, he came out of Burlington, Vermont, and it's kind of intriguing that he actually lived in Burlington, Ontario, you know, as a broadcaster in Toronto. He did work with the Expos. I'm assuming that he, you know, there was an opening for the position in Toronto, and he had a commanding voice, and that must have been a contributing factor to it. He had some early challenges because his first the guy sitting with him was Early Wynn, and Early Wynn was I guess a lovable character in some ways, but you know, I always remember a friend of mine telling me he almost drove his car over a bridge when Early was explaining how the batting average worked, that somebody started with 1,000 at the start of the year, and if they got out, they lost a point, and by the end of the season, they might be around 280 or something like that. And he said, what? So there were challenges with Early Wynn, lasted about 3 or 4 years, I think, with the team, and then Jerry Howarth came in and that stable, as it were, of Tom and Jerry survived to the basically the end of Tom's career.
Did you talk about Tom in the year after his passing in the course?
We did. You know, they were obviously, they'd grown up listening to Tom Cheek, Tom and Jerry in particular. And so that adjustment of a new voice, and the Jays did have several voices that they tried to bring in. And in some ways, they still continue to experiment with that position. I mean, this year we have Jack Morris there replacing Alan Ashby. Occasionally we hear Mike Wilner in the broadcast. I think what's happened with the broadcasting side in Toronto is they beefed it up considerably with people like Dirk Hayhurst and others, so that you'll often hear different voices on the television and the radio.
That is all I have for you. I want to thank you for coming on the show today and taking the time to give us some background on all of these guys. And hope you have a great time this weekend in St. Mary's.
St. Mary's and London. I'm going down tomorrow, and then Friday is the baseball breakfast. So it should be interesting to hear the stories that are told.
And that's it for today's episode. I'd like to thank Bill Humber for his support of the Canadian Baseball Network and for coming on the show today. I'd also like to thank the Isotopes for their music and Effective Business Video for the production. If you have a suggestion for our show, please let us know by sending us an email at canadianbaseballnetwork@gmail.com or send us a message on Twitter or Facebook. Next week, we'll be back with more interviews with Canadian draftees. Thanks for listening to the Canadian Baseball Network podcast, and have a happy Canada Day.